Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Baruch Spinoza, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 1.
In 1656, the elders of the Jewish synagogue in Amsterdam pronounced the following judgment.
With the judgment of the angels and the saints, we excommunicate, cut off, curse, and anathematize Baruch de Espinosa. With the anathema wherewith Joshua cursed Jericho, with the curse which Elisha laid upon the children, and with all the curses which are written in the law. Cursed be he by day, and cursed be he by night. Cursed be he in sleeping, and cursed be he in waking. Cursed in going out, and cursed in coming in. The Lord shall not pardon him. The wrath and fury of the Lord shall henceforth be kindled against this man, and he shall lay upon him all the curses which are written in the book of the law. The Lord shall destroy his name under the sun, and cut him off for his undoing from all the tribes of Israel. And we warn you that none may speak with him by word of mouth, nor by writing, nor show any favor to him, nor be under one roof with him, nor come within 4 cubits of him, nor read any papers composed or written by him.
With this terrifying pronouncement, the leaders of the Amsterdam synagogue excommunicated the brightest young man in their community. His ideas were too heretical, too new and dangerous for them, so they severed their relationship with him forever. At the age of 24, Spinoza was irrevocably cut off from his family and from the community where he'd grown up, studied, worked, and worshipped. What were these ideas of his which provoked the temple elders to such drastic measures? Well, they were ideas about God and nature, about the Bible and politics, about how human beings ought to live, and about the greatest joy we can aspire to. They're timeless ideas. They've influenced serious thinkers for centuries. Though they cost Spinoza his place in the community, they've earned for him a place in the permanent roster of truly profound and original philosophers. Different ages have understood Spinoza's ideas in very different ways. For example, in the 18th century, he was referred to as an infamous atheist. In the 19th century, the German author Novalis said of him,
"Spinoza was a God-intoxicated man."
Because of his carefully logical, rational way of thinking, scientists have often found Spinoza to be appealing. Einstein, for example, called himself a disciple of Spinoza. On the other hand, romantic poets have also found in him a kindred spirit. Coleridge and Goethe, Matthew Arnold and Heinrich Heine, all have praised the sensitivity and beauty of his thought. Goethe wrote, for example,
"I hurried back again and again to those works of his to which I was so indebted. The same air of peace blew over me. I gave myself over to the reading of Spinoza. And while I thereby looked upon myself, I believed that I had never looked upon the world with such clarity."
What kind of philosophy could appeal so deeply both to analytically minded scientists and to romantic visionaries and poets? What kind of theology could provoke charges both of atheism and of God intoxication? What kind of a man was Spinoza that he could endure the trauma of excommunication and public disgrace and yet write works which breathe an air of the deepest calm and serenity? Baruch Spinoza was born in 1632 in the bustling city of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. Perhaps no other city of that time was quite as vital, quite as prosperous, or quite as progressive. 17th century Amsterdam was home to Rembrandt, a neighbor of Spinoza's. It was also home to Leeuwenhoek, the inventor of the microscope, and to Christian Huygens, the famous mathematician and physicist. Commerce was king. The harbor was filled with trading ships returning from distant lands laden with exotic wares. Amsterdam was also a center for free trade in ideas, at least by the standards of the time. In fact, the city's tolerance of religious diversity led Spinoza's parents to settle there when they were forced to leave their native Portugal. The Spinozas were Jewish, and the Catholic Inquisition offered the Jews in Spain and Portugal only three alternatives: conversion to Christianity, death, or exile. The families of Michael and Hannah Deborah de Spinoza chose exile, sailed to Amsterdam, and settled into the city's sizable Jewish enclave. Michael and Hannah Deborah chose the name Baruch for their son, a name which means blessed in Hebrew. Baruch Spinoza was educated in a Jewish boys' school. He may have thought of becoming a rabbi, but as his studies progressed, he became less and less convinced by his teacher's orthodox interpretation of the Hebrew scriptures and commentaries. Baruch sharpened his mind to a fine edge through the study of these works, but he was not satisfied with them. As a teenager, Spinoza became curious about other ideas. He undertook to learn Latin so he could also study the works of Christian and secular thinkers. At the time, almost all such works were written in Latin. However, these interests on the part of a young man may have seemed a little suspect in the Jewish community. Latin, in addition to being the universal language of the learned, also was the clerical language of the hated Inquisition. The more Spinoza studied the works of other philosophers and theologians, the more his thinking differed from the views of his teachers and his fellows in the synagogue. Perhaps it was inevitable that his own unorthodox ideas would bring him into conflict with the authorities of the Jewish community. He was offered the chance to recant his heresies, but he refused to compromise. And so, just as his parents had been forced into exile from Portugal because they wouldn't abandon their religious beliefs, so Spinoza was exiled from his community for refusing to relinquish his philosophical convictions. After his excommunication at the age of 24, Spinoza changed his first name, Baruch, to its Latin equivalent, Benedictus. He lived a quiet life, talking sometimes with a group of Protestant Christians, unorthodox, like himself. He exchanged letters with various important businessmen, philosophers, and scientists who showed an interest in his ideas. An early biographer, Colerus, provides the following description of his appearance as a young man.
He was of a middle size. He had good features in his face. The skin somewhat black, the hair dark and curly, the eyebrows long and black, so that one might easily know by his looks that he was descended from Portuguese Jews. As for his clothes, he was very careless of them, and they were not better than those of the meanest citizen. One of the most eminent councillors of state went to see him and found him in a very untidy morning gown, whereupon the counselor reproached him for it and offered him another. Spinoza answered him that a man was never the better for having a fine gown.
Spinoza's frugality showed not only in his clothes but in his entire manner of life. He lived in self-imposed poverty, making his very modest living as a lens grinder. On several occasions, people offered him considerable sums of money, but he never accepted. A friend, Simon de Vries, tried to give him 2,000 florins, about $1,000, to make his life easier. But Spinoza asked that he make the gift smaller, explaining that such a large sum would surely distract him from his work and his studies. In 1673, Spinoza was approached by a representative of the Elector Palatine, Karl Ludwig, who invited him to assume the prestigious position of professor of philosophy at the University of Heidelberg. Again, Spinoza turned down the opportunity to achieve a comfortable income and great professional status. The invitation had indicated that he would be allowed full freedom of philosophizing, but on the condition that he not undermine the established Protestant Reformed religion. Spinoza replied in a characteristically polite letter,
"If I had ever entertained a wish to take on a professorship in any faculty, I could have desired no other than that which is offered me through you by His Serene Highness the Elector Palatine, particularly on account of that freedom of philosophizing which the most gracious prince is pleased to offer, to say nothing of my long-felt desire to live under the rule of a prince whose wisdom all admire. Since, however, it was never my intention to give public instruction, I cannot be induced to embrace this glorious opportunity."
In a later passage of the letter, Spinoza voices his deeper concerns regarding the position offered him.
I think that I do not know within what limits that freedom of philosophizing ought to be confined in order to avoid the appearance of wishing to disturb the publicly established religion. For schisms arise not so much from an ardent love of religion, but from men's various dispositions, or the love of contradiction, through which they are wont to distort and to condemn all things, even those which have been correctly stated. I have already experienced these things while living a private and solitary life, much more than are they to be feared after I shall have been raised to this honored position. Thus you see, most honored sir, that I am not holding back in the hope of some better fortune, but from love of peace.
Spinoza's peace and quiet were too important to him to risk the distractions and the political pressures which would accompany a prestigious academic position. In the 20 years between his excommunication and his death at age 44, Spinoza moved 5 different times to various cities in the Netherlands. In each city, he rented a room in the house of a local inhabitant. Colerus, his biographer, tells us the following about his daily life.
His amusements were very simple. Talking on ordinary matters with the people of the house, smoking now and again a pipe of tobacco, watching the habits and quarrels of insects, making observations with a microscope. Such were his pastimes in the hours which he could spare from his philosophy. But the greater part of his day was taken up with severe mental work in his room. Sometimes he would become so absorbed that he would remain alone for 2 or 3 days together, his meals being brought up to him.
Thus Spinoza worked away at his lenses and his philosophy in the cramped quarters which were his home. The glass dust, which he must have breathed constantly, weakened his lungs, and he died quietly of tuberculosis one Sunday afternoon in his last home city, The Hague. The simplicity and calm of Spinoza's life have spoken to later generations of his admirers as eloquently as have his written works. Matthew Arnold summed up the views of many as he wrote,
"Spinoza led a life, the most spotless, perhaps, to be found among the lives of the philosophers. He lived simple, studious, even-tempered, kind, declining honors, declining riches, declining notoriety. Therefore, he has been in a certain sphere edifying and has inspired in many powerful minds an interest and an admiration such as no other philosopher has inspired since Plato."
During Spinoza's short lifetime, he published only 1 book openly and 1 anonymously. At his death, his main work, an unpublished book called The Ethics, was left locked in a drawer. It was delivered to a friend who arranged for it to be published along with some of his letters and 2 other unfinished manuscripts. These few works are all that remain of Spinoza's thought. But in them we find a worldview and a philosophy of life unsurpassed in its scope, in its intellectual rigor, and according to some, in its relevance for our lives today. When we reflect that Spinoza's personal convictions cost him his place in the community, his relationship with his family, and the pleasures of wealth and status, we might wonder what motivated him to pursue his philosophical reflections with such tenacity. His works contain very little self-disclosure, but in the opening paragraphs of one of his unfinished manuscripts, he does relate his reasons for pursuing philosophical truth. He says that, like every human being, he was seeking happiness, true, permanent happiness, and that he'd been unable to find that in those things that attract most people's attentions.
"After experience had taught me that all the usual surroundings of social life are vain and futile, I finally resolved to inquire whether there might be some real good having power to communicate itself, which would affect the mind singly, to the exclusion of all else, whether, in fact, there might be anything the discovery and attainment of which would enable me to enjoy continuous, supreme, and unending happiness.
These words reveal a spirit which is found in many of the great philosophers, a sense that there must be something permanent, more meaningful, and more deeply satisfying than the usual pleasures of social life, politics, or business. Spinoza looks around at the citizens of Amsterdam and sees that most people focus their lives on the search for riches, for honor and fame, or for the pleasures of food, drink, and sex. He suggests that he himself has experienced his share of these things, but that they've left him unfulfilled. Not only are these pleasures unsatisfying in the long run, but they're a source of considerable trouble, even danger.
There are many examples of people who have suffered persecution, even to death, for the sake of their riches, and of men who, in pursuit of wealth, have exposed themselves to so many dangers that they have paid away their lives as a penalty for their folly. Examples are no less numerous of men who have endured the utmost wretchedness for the sake of gaining or preserving their reputation. Lastly, there are innumerable cases of men who have hastened their death through overindulgence in sensual pleasure.
Looking at the unhappiness around him and at the misery often brought by the search for wealth, power, and sensual pleasure, Spinoza noticed a pattern. It seems that our happiness depends upon the nature of the things that we love and devote ourselves to. If these things are inherently unstable and undependable, so too our happiness will be unstable and wavering. If the things we devote ourselves to can't reliably be controlled, then our own happiness will be hostage to the shifting winds of fortune, of the market, or of the opinion of others. In this aversion to fleeting and elusive goals, Spinoza agrees with the wisdom of the ancient Stoics. They held that most human misery occurs because people become emotionally attached to things which are easily lost and which are unreliable or perishable. Spinoza saw that the only way to achieve true and permanent happiness is to find something less changeable and more reliable to focus our love upon. So he embarked on a search for such a thing. Though not without some trepidation, he had no assurances that he'd find what he sought. But find it he did, and in the process Spinoza underwent a kind of transformation that he would later describe as liberation or salvation. What he found was as old as the most ancient religions and as modern as natural science. He called it God, but it had little in common with the Lord of Moses or the Trinity of the Christians. Baruch Spinoza's writings make important and original contributions in two different areas of philosophy. First is his account of God and his relationship to the world. This includes Spinoza's extended and detailed critique of traditional theology and religion. The second area is that which might be called Spinoza's moral psychology. That is, his account of how, through philosophical understanding, we might become better human beings and ultimately achieve permanent happiness, or, as he called it, blessedness. Spinoza's views on God and blessedness are closely related. He holds that we must overcome the prejudices and illusions of traditional theology if we're to gain the insight that makes blessedness possible. So the order of ideas themselves dictates the order in which they must be considered. First, God, then human beings and their happiness. Appropriately, Spinoza chose the title Concerning God for the first part of his most important work, The Ethics. In these pages, Spinoza describes his conception of the nature of God and criticizes traditional Judeo-Christian theology. These pages are among the densest and most difficult to understand in all of Western philosophy. While the general outlines of Spinoza's view were clear enough, scholars have argued for two centuries about the specifics. Our consideration of his philosophy must begin with those abstract metaphysical ideas which generations of scholars have found so difficult. But fortunately, once his general concept of God is understood, the thicket of abstractions dissolves and reveals a worldview that makes sense of nature, of ourselves as part of nature. A philosophical vision emerges that provided Spinoza with the happiness he sought, and which has seemed to many readers, from Coleridge to Einstein, to be as close to truth as philosophy has ever come.
This is the end of part one. Please download part two to continue.